Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. Hi, I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I'm your host of Yoga Birth Babies. And today we're going to talk about inductions. So when I thought about this podcast, in my brain I organized it as the yes, no, and maybe two inductions. We talk about what are medically indicated reasons, what are not medically indicated reasons, and then what falls in that gray space, the maybe. So to have this conversation, I have Marley Hall. Now, those that are on social media know her as Midwife Marley. She is a midwife of 13 years. She's a registered midwife and mother of five from London, UK. And she's also the author of a new book, Midwife Marley's Guide for Everyone, Pregnancy, Birth, and the Fourth Trimester. And Marley is just truly lovely to speak with. I had such a fantastic conversation. She is thorough and in-depth and easy to listen to and easy to talk to. And we cover some wonderful information about induction, as well as how to have a conversation with your care provider if you are talking about induction, and really how to advocate for yourself. I think you're absolutely going to walk away from this conversation feeling empowered and feeling like you have some direction and voice in how your birth unfolds. So before we get to that conversation, I just want to remind everybody about a few things happening at the studio at Prenatal Yoga Center. So we've had students asking, as the world has very much reopened, what we're planning on doing about our online classes. So just this morning, I was teaching online. I teach every Tuesday. I teach at home from my basement studio. And I keep thinking, I'm like, how long am I going to do this? But just this morning, we had somebody from New Orleans. We had somebody from California. We had somebody from Canada. When I see how many people are tuning in from all around the world, it makes me think, why would I stop this? Yes, many of us are seeing each other in person at our Upper West Side studio, but many people can't do that. And what I've really enjoyed is growing this community. So I see no reason to change that. So we're going to continue our online classes, our hybrid classes, and our in-person classes for as long as you want us, we'll be there. So you can always check out our classes at prenatalyogacenter.com. And of course, our workshops and our on-demand classes. Now, for the times that you can't quite make it to class, or maybe yoga's just not your thing, but you still have some aches and pains, head to our website and download your free downloadable, your free guide, 5 Simple Solutions to the Most Common Pregnancy Pains. And you can substitute the word postpartum for pregnancy, because whether you just had a baby or you're pregnant, you might still have back pain, you might still have neck pain, you might still have hip pain. So I got you covered there. And then the last thing I want to share, what we've decided to do with our teacher training. So we are keeping it online and in person. So twice a year, we will be in person. Twice a year, we'll be online. And then I've been approached from some studios to bring our very intense, very wonderful and thorough training to some other studios. So you might see me popping around the U.S. And then once a year, we do a postnatal teacher training. You can all check that out online at our website. All right, I lied. This is my very last thing I want to share. And it's more about serving you. If there is a podcast topic I haven't done, or maybe I've done, but you want me to go in a different direction or deeper, I want to hear from you. I want to hear what topics you want to hear about. I'm here to serve you and support you. So if there's something I haven't done, or you want a different angle, let me know. You can reach me at deb@prenatalyogacenter.com. Okay, we're going to take a super quick break. When we come back, please enjoy my absolutely lovely, wonderful conversation with Marley Hall, Midwife Marley. Hi, Marley. How are you?
I'm really, really well, thank you. And I'm delighted to be here chatting with you today.
Thank you. I am so excited to pick your brain on many things. I want to talk about your new book, and I want to talk about induction. So I'm really thrilled to jump in. So I guess we should start with, I'd love to learn a little bit about you and what led you to midwifery.
Well, gosh. So I'm a midwife. I'm in the UK and I've been a midwife for 13 years. And I guess my journey to midwifery began when I was 18 and I was having my first baby. And I didn't know anything about pregnancy. You know, obviously I was very young and didn't know anything about birth. And I went into labor. And it was the midwife and her assistant or her student that were looking after me. And they were so wonderful and amazing. I thought to myself, you know what? I would love to do that. I would love to make women feel like they made me feel, you know, one day. Mm. And it was just kind of like a fleeting thought. But then, because then I went to university and studied broadcast media because I was going to be a journalist. But then when I finished that degree, I was like, you know what? I still want to be a midwife. So I decided to go back and train as a midwife because obviously over here in the UK, we don't have labour nurses. We have midwives in hospitals. So that's what I did. And then I started my journey and I had twin boys when I was in my third year of my midwifery course. And by the time I qualified, I had three children. Fast forward a few years and here we are. So I've worked in lots of different areas. I've worked in hospitals. I've worked in birth centres. I've worked in people's homes. I've done home birth. Worked in the community in clinics. I've had quite a vast range of experience in different settings, which has been really good, actually, really good for me and my learning, you know. Now I don't work in the NHS anymore, the National Health Service. I work independently. So I work as a private midwife and I primarily do like antenatal or prenatal care and postnatal care as well. So once the baby's been born, not doing births at the moment, but that's mainly because I've got so many children to kind of deal with myself that being on call would be a bit tricky for me, perhaps until they're a little bit older.
So, how many kids do you have?
I've got five. I've got five children now and they range in ages from, well, my youngest is three and then I have a five-year-old and my twins are 14 and my eldest is 22.
Wow, so, that is the range.
Yeah.
And your hands are full. That's amazing. I can hear them in the background. That's what life as a parent is. I mean, the only reason I can do this so easily right now is because my kids are in school. But when they weren't, I totally understand that. So that's amazing. I love to hear about how long you've been doing this and about your background. And I totally agree that having the opportunity to practice midwifery in so many different places really can inform so much of your learning and how you're not pigeonholed into one way of seeing things. It really can broaden your experience.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, when I first qualified as a midwife, we had to do like this rotation around the maternity unit in the hospital. So you have to do, you know, like a year on the labor ward or the delivery suite. Then you have to move on and work in the postnatal area. And then you have to go into the community. So it was nice actually that once I had left, so I'd done my year on the labor ward, you know, it was a high risk unit. So lots of people coming in with complications and there was, you know, epidurals and inductions and cesarean sections and all that kind of thing. So there was lots of that. And then by the time I actually got out into the community and started running clinics and doing home births, it was like, oh my gosh, there's a totally different side of it, mm-hmm. you know? And it was a real eye-opener to be able to see all the different aspects of pregnancy and birth care. You know, not just what you kind of see on TV, which is, you know, women going into hospitals and having kind of high risk care. So yeah, it was a real eye opener. And midwifery is a lifelong learning experience. You know, there's no 2 days are the same, no two women are the same, and we just learn so much, which is why I love it.
Yeah, I remember when I was a doula, having done many hospital births and then having the first home birth, and I'm like, wow, I didn't know birth yeah. could be this way. All right, I'm going to pull us back on topic because I'm so excited to talk about induction. So let's jump into this. So I was doing a little research for our conversation, and I'm so curious to hear about some of the UK numbers, because one thing I found when I was looking at some data, and the only data I could find reflecting the induction rates in the US was from 2018. And what it was saying that in 2018, 25.7% of people, pregnant folks, including 31% of first time births were induced. So it's about a third of parents being induced, which seems kind of bonkers. A third of parents being induced. Yeah. Do you happen to know what the rates are in the UK?
It's about the same, actually. And I know like old figures would say that, you know, one in five births, so 20% are induced. But now we know more recent figures. I mean, obviously, it depends from area to area and hospital to hospital. But anywhere between 25 and, you know, 32-33%. So it's probably around the same, actually, as over in the US. It is crazy. I mean, you know, interventions, inductions, assisted births, they're all there for a reason, and they are needed in a lot of cases, but I definitely think they're being overused, you know.
Yeah. So that's why when I was creating this idea for today's conversation, it was my brain's like the yes, no, and the maybe. So as you said, there are absolutely times where interventions are a life-saving tool, and then other times we're like, really? And then other times we're like, maybe. So I guess we should jump into where should we start? Maybe let's start with a little bit of information about induction, and what would you consider medically indicated? And let's also define what that would be, a medically indicated induction.
Okay. So there, when you think about induction, for medical reasons, you have to think about the risks. So what are, you know, do the risks of the baby remaining inside, sorry, do the risks of the baby being born outweigh the risk of the baby remaining inside for either the mum or the baby or both? So that's what we have to consider. So, you know, if there is the option to keep baby inside for a little bit longer to grow, because obviously we know babies need, really they need at least 39 weeks to grow properly, even though they might be the right size, you know, you have to think about brain and lung development. So, you know, does the baby need to be born, and what will happen if the baby isn't born right now? Is that going to have an impact on mum or baby? So there are several cases, really. I mean, you think about things like severe preeclampsia. So with severe preeclampsia, the only known cure really is to get the placenta out. And the only way you're going to get the placenta out is to get the baby out. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has severe preeclampsia, and, you know, it's likely to get worse and cause problems, then an induction might be offered. Now, I've worked with lots of people who have had preeclampsia, and it's been mild and it's been managed and monitored just to get them through the last couple of weeks of pregnancy so their baby's, you know, a bit more mature and ready to be born. So it's a case of kind of weighing it up and, you know, do we need to get the baby out now? And that kind of all depends on blood levels and things like, and blood pressure and that kind of thing. Another reason would be something like intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. Or obstetric cholestasis. So that's a liver problem, and that's where there's a problem with the bile acids. Now, we know that people who develop that, they tend to develop it some point in the third trimester, and often it if it's quite severe, sometimes babies need to come out early, you know, 35 weeks, 36 weeks, 37 weeks sometimes, because it's better for the baby to be out rather than in, you know, because the rates of stillbirth are increased. If somebody has perhaps uncontrolled or very unstable diabetes, then again, that might be another reason to consider induction. And again, even with diabetes, there's such a huge range. You know, some people have it mildly and they can control it with their food. You know, you might have somebody who's type 2 diabetic and it's well controlled, or you might have somebody who's got gestational diabetes and again they're controlling it okay, and they are they're okay to kind of go closer to full term or as close to full term as possible. Other people, there might be some problems or some indications for induction. Another reason, actually, probably one that I actually experienced myself. I didn't end up having an induction for this, so I had a cesarean section. This was for my twins. So you've heard of IUGR, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Yeah. So growth restriction. Yeah. So one of my twins, they were fraternal twins. So not identical. And one of them had stopped growing. He was kind of measuring very, very small. Now, just measuring small alone isn't a reason to induce a baby, because some babies are small. You know, we have to look at people. We have to look at things holistically. You know, it's like when you have parents from certain parts of the world, you know, you go to the Far East and perhaps people are a lot smaller, people are a lot shorter, babies are a lot smaller. So we can't kind of put everybody in the same bracket. We have to look at each person individually. So just simply having a baby that's a little bit on the small side isn't necessarily a reason to induce. We have to think, well, why is the baby small? Is there a problem with the placenta? And that's why we then, you know, do the Dopplers to check the blood flow through the placenta, et cetera. So with my one of my twins, he had stopped growing. So we did further scans and we found out that actually the blood flow through the placenta wasn't very good. And his growth basically more or less stopped over several days. So I was 34 weeks at that point, and I'd already been through a vaginal birth before. So I knew what to expect. And I knew, being a student midwife at the time, that my chances of having a successful induction at 34 weeks were probably very, very slim, because my body was nowhere near ready. And then on top of that, I've got a compromised baby. So do I want to put him through synthetic contractions? You know, probably not. So the decision was made to have a cesarean. So that's another reason, perhaps, that somebody might consider, you know, an induction or getting the baby out early if perhaps there's growth restriction. So those really are the key medical indications for induction of labour. But obviously there are lots more. You know, going overdue isn't a medical indication for an induction of labour. But I guess we'll move on to that shortly.
Yes, we will. So this was when I was thinking about the yes, no, the maybe. This feels like we're definitely hitting the yes pile. Like if your care provider saying, okay, you have cholestasis, this isn't, we're like, well, how much more time? Because I invite my students to think of three questions. Am I okay? Mm-hmm. Meaning the pregnant person. Is the baby okay? Can we have more time? In all these cases, no, like you don't get more time because we did not check those boxes. So this really can highlight that. So let's talk about then, and I'm going to kind of bop around my questions. So these were clearly medically indicated. Mm. So let's talk about, and you kind of open that door for, this is kind of a big meaty question, those that are not medically indicated, like passing one's due date, for example. Let's walk through that door.
Gosh, well, this is such a big topic, and there's so much contradictory advice. There's so many contradictory studies, and it's a real minefield. It's a minefield for parents, but it's also a minefield for health professionals as well, because, you know, I've read a lot of research around due dates and things, and a lot of stats. And, you know, when we're talking about things like stillbirth rates, which is the main thing that people worry about, you know, if I go overdue, is my placenta going to fail? And, you know, I don't want my baby to die. And it's something that we don't want to think about, really. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's something that's kind of thrown on us if we go past our due date. And historically, you know, parents were told, well, if you go past 42 weeks, you know, your placenta is going to fail, and, you know, your risk of stillbirth shoots up. Well, when I had a little look at the Office for National Statistics, and I looked at the stillbirth rates by gestation. I was really surprised. This is in the UK. I was really surprised. I actually wrote about this in my book. And I found that, and this was data from, I think, 2017 to 2018, off the top of my head. And I found that it showed that at 39 and 40 weeks gestation, the stillbirth rate was 0.93 per 1,000 babies, right? At 41 weeks, actually, no, sorry, I've got the wrong way around. At 39 and 40 weeks, the stillbirth rate was 1.03 per 1,000.
Okay.
At 41 weeks, the stillbirth rate was 0.93.
So it went down.
Yes. So I'm looking, thinking, what? That doesn't make any sense. That goes against everything I've been told. But these are just black and white stats. So at this gestation, this, you know, these number of babies were stillborn. So I'm thinking, it doesn't make any sense to me at all, because I've been told that, you know, the risk goes up. But I think what the problem is we're not looking at other problems that people may well have had during their pregnancy. So when we're talking about, you know, placentas failing, we're not necessarily looking at healthy, low-risk people. We're perhaps looking at people with other comorbidities, you know, other problems, perhaps blood pressure issues or other issues that may not necessarily have been documented. So what I worry about is people kind of jumping on the, you know, got to be induced at this gestation train without looking at the person holistically. And, you know, because when I used to look after people in the community who used to come to my clinics, they would come and see me at 40 weeks and then see me at 41 weeks. And then the policy from the hospital says that we're supposed to book them in for an induction of labour. But not everybody wants an induction of labour. So I would often get people who'd come to me at 42 weeks. They're still fine. There's no blood pressure issues. There's no protein in their urine. They're not feeling unwell. The babies, there's plenty of movements. The pregnancy, they've sailed through it. There's been no issues at all. So I asked them, well, what do you want to do? You know, and they're like, oh, I've got a choice. I'm like, of course you've got a choice. You know, it's totally down to you. They're like, okay, well, let's just wait a few more days. You know, and then they often just go into labour by themselves anyway. But what we do is we offer them additional monitoring. So we say, okay, well, if you want to come into the hospital once a day and have a CTG, which I think you guys over there call it an non-stress test.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Just to make sure everything's okay with the baby's heart rate and what have you. And the amount of people that were like, okay, well, I'll do that then, you know, and see how it goes, was quite astonishing, really. But I think what does happen is you do get to a certain gestation where you are more likely to have complications. You know, the stillbirth rate goes up very slightly. And when I say slightly, I mean very slightly, like, you know, a point of a percent from 43 weeks onwards. We know that much. But most people don't go to 43 weeks. Most people will give birth before that. But now, especially over here in the UK, new guidelines have been suggested to induce even before the due date. So if you are for a black or ethnic minority, for example, if you have got a higher BMI, if you are if you've had IVF, and there's several other reasons as well, then to be offered an induction of labour at 39 weeks, which actually we all kind of protested about because that seems absolutely ludicrous, especially if the pregnancy is okay. If there's nothing wrong with the pregnancy, why on earth are we offering people an induction of labour at 39 weeks? Because someone's black? Well, we know what the stats say around that. We know that the stats say that black women over here are four times more likely to die. But is the answer just to whip the baby out at 39 weeks? Because then we're not considering the other issues that an induction of labour might cause. You know, and I say this as a person who's been induced, you know, I've actually had three inductions, you know, so but I made those decisions in a fully informed manner, you know, and that's what it's all about. It's all about informed choice. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to be offering these procedures, then we need to give everybody all the information they need. We need to be talking about the benefits and the risks. And we don't talk about the risks enough, you know.
I would do. I want to talk about the risks. I know I'm veering slightly off topic, but we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's have a clearer picture. And I know there's still other not medical reasons that someone may be asked to be induced, like big baby. So we'll get to that. But before we get to that, let's just open it up and say, look at the pros and cons that people, as you said, can make informed decisions. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so let's go into that. So if people are going to make informed decisions, they need both sides of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I like to use, which you probably heard of as well, the BRAIN acronym.
Yep.
For asking questions. And that goes with anything. That goes with any kind of investigation, treatment, intervention, anything. Anything that's been offered to you.
Let's just give that in case people are like, what is that? It's benefit risk. What was A?
Alternative
intuition, yeah. And then nothing.
Yeah. So the first one, you know, and this is all about asking questions. So if you ask, if you're offered an induction of labor, you want to ask, well, what are the benefits? How is this going to benefit me and my baby? You know, is this a life-threatening situation where if the baby doesn't come out, you know, in the next few days or whatever, there's a high chance that something is going to happen. And if there's a high chance, what is that chance? You know, I want figures. I want numbers. You know, it's no good saying to clients, to patients that, oh, you know, that you've got an increased risk. Well, but what is that risk? You know, are we talking about the risk goes from 1 in 1,000 to 1.2 in 1,000? You know, is that a real increase, a significant increased risk? So this is a problem when we think about numbers, you know. So to ask, what are the benefits? And then ask, what are the risks? So, you know, you've told me what the benefits are. Okay, so the benefits are the baby can come out into the outside world and has got a better chance outside than in. So what are the risks? Well, we need to know what the risks of induction of labor are. There's different types of induction, and you might want to discuss those later on. But if we are talking about a medical induction which goes through everything, so we're talking about amniotomy, which is breaking the waters. We're talking about prostaglandin gels or tablets to soften and dilate the cervix, and then even moving on to the synthetic oxytocin drip. What are the risks of all those things? You know, because it's not just a case of just giving you some drugs and your labor starts. And then, are there any alternatives? Is there anything else we can do? You know, is there anything else we can do if I've got a, you know, some kind of medical condition? Is there any medication I can take? Is there anything holistically I can do? Alternative therapies I can try to help the situation? There might not be. but it's always worthwhile asking the question. And then we move on to I, which is intuition. What is your gut telling you deep down? Listen to yourself. Listen to yourself. We don't listen to ourselves enough, you know, or we're a bit unsure. Oh, I'm not sure, you know, but I always say intuition, your intuition is 9 times out of 10 right. And it's the same when you have your baby. I hear so many mothers who come to me and they say, you know, I went to the doctors 5 times because there's something wrong with my baby. They just turn me away. And then, you know, something ends up happening. Listen to your intuition. And actually, we need to listen to parents as well. We need to be listening to them because they know their bodies and they know their babies mm-hmm. better than we do. And then N would be nothing. So, okay, so if we do nothing and, you know, I decide not to take the treatment or the intervention or investigation or whatever, what's going to happen? You know, what's likely to happen? So by using that brain acronym, that'll help you get those answers so that you can make that decision yourself. And the decision is for you to make. It's not for anybody else to make. It's for you. And that would be, once you've gone through the brain acronym and you've made your decision, then you've made an informed one. You know, obviously, as long as you've got the answers that you're, you know, to the questions that you're looking for, then you've got the answers to those things. But it's definitely important to start there. Before you can make an informed choice.
And this is so helpful because people may start to hear from their care provider, oh, you're 40 weeks. I think we should start talking induction. Actually, as you mentioned, I feel like I hear students say that at 39 weeks. And then I've also heard students say, oh, my doctor thinks my baby's going to be big, which I'd love to talk about that. You know, what my care provider is talking about inducing me. They're afraid baby's too big. So what you just gave is a great way to have a non-confrontational conversation with the care provider. I hear you. Thank you. Let's go through this list and that way I can make an informed decision. And I find that students, I call them students because they're my yoga students, are sometimes intimidated to broach the topic, but I think by coming at it with this really mindful list, the brain acronym, it can make the conversation feel less intimidating.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. And I think, you know, people do feel scared to ask questions, you know, because I think they often feel like, you know, well, why am I questioning the doctor or why am I questioning the health professional? You know, they know best, you know, and actually, you know yourself best. Mm-hmm. You know, you really do know yourself best. And you may well go ahead and agree to an intervention, which is fine. Or you may disagree. And, you know, but as long as you've had that conversation, that is the main thing.
I could not agree more. So I've been itching to talk about the big baby. So I hear this a lot. In fact, I heard this with my own. They weren't talking induction, but I remember the midwife, she got her hands on my belly and she's like, I think it's about 8 pounds. And I'm like, well, cause my first child was 8 pounds. With my second, I'm like, okay, I did it once. I can do it again. She was seven. She was 7 pounds. So, and it was a much easier birth for many reasons, but whatever. So yeah. So that gets into people's heads when they hear you're going to have a big baby. People are like, oh, geez. And then there's the invitation for induction. I'd love just to open this for you to talk about.
Oh, gosh. You know, this is something that is brought up every single day. You know, I see it on social media all the time. And, you know, and then I'll hear things like, oh, I was told that I'm having a big baby. One lady was really angry because she got taken for a cesarean because she was told her baby's going to be 12 pounds and it came out and I think the baby was like 6.5 or something. I mean, anybody that palpates your abdomen, anyone that feels your abdomen and says, oh, I think it's a guess. There's no way that we can tell, you know, accurately how big a baby is going to be just by feeling the size of its head or by feeling your belly. We can't do that. Even ultrasound scans, ultrasound scans are good, but they're not incredibly accurate at predicting weight, you know. And I actually put a poll up on my Instagram a couple of months ago, I think, asking people, you know, would you give in a growth scan? And the next question was, you know, if so, was your was the growth accurate? And I think something like 85% of people said no. You know, it wasn't. And it's significantly, you know, not accurate at all. So over here, the guidelines over here for offering an induction for suspected big baby state that doctors and midwives should not, under any circumstances, be offering or discussing an induction of labour on the basis of a suspected big baby in the absence of any other problems. So now, if somebody has diabetes and the baby is suspected to be significantly large, that's different because you've got two issues there. You've got one that we think the baby might be big, and secondly, you've got the diabetes, you know. So if someone's baby is suspected to be big and there's other issues as well, you're thinking, oh, gosh, there's this and there's this and there's this, then perhaps, you know, have the conversation. But again, you don't have to agree. And then you need to be asking, well, what does it mean? You know, what are the risks of having a big baby? You know, we're talking about shoulder dystocia. If that's the case, well, what are the risks? Actually, majority of babies that have a shoulder dystocia are actually normal weight. You know, mm-hmm. We know that it happens slightly more in bigger babies. So the rate of shoulder dystocia is slightly higher in bigger babies than it is normal sized babies. But in general, the majority of babies whose shoulders get stuck are actually normal or below average weight. Okay. So it's all about asking what the stats are. What are the numbers? So asking what the risks are. But yeah, in general, just by sort of, you know, saying, oh, well, I think it could be, you know, the scan says, we've got to remember as well that ultrasound scans are machinery, you know, it's equipment. And it also depends a lot on where the sonographer places the little X's when they're doing the measurements. I had a client of mine a couple of weeks ago who was telling me about her previous birth. And she said that she had two ultrasound scans done. One was done privately because she didn't believe the NHS one. So the NHS one, I think she was about 38 weeks, and it estimated the baby was going to weigh about 11 pounds. She went for a private scan, I think a few days later, and it said about 7 pounds. So she was like, what on earth? You know, two different ultrasonographers, two different facilities, and they gave her two completely different ultrasound scan reports. So it's just something we just need to be mindful of. And I'm not saying that, you know, shoulder dystocia and other complications don't occur, because they do, but we just need to take everything into consideration. And also, when we're thinking about giving birth, I mean, obviously, I know you're an expert in yoga, things like exercise, getting into certain positions, mm-hmm. Are going to be beneficial in reducing the chance of your baby's shoulder getting stuck. You know, I've been there. I've helped 12, 13-pound babies come out vaginally with no problem whatsoever. But these women weren't lying flat on their backs, on their backs, on the beds with their legs up. They were doing whatever they wanted to do. They were moving around freely, and they were instinctively or intuitively getting into the position that they felt that they needed to birth their big babies, you know?
I do. In fact, so that's something when I've had students say, oh, my care provider thinks it's going to be big. Mm. I try to look at the pause and say, that's then a fantastic conversation, saying, thank you for this information. Now we need to talk about alternative birthing positions. So make more space in the pelvis. Let that sacrum swing out of the way. How can we use our legs to internally rotate, to widen the outlet? So I try to then reflect it back to the student to talk to their care provider about, instead of going at it with fear, going at it with a sense of working with this information and empowerment. Okay, baby's big. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm on my side. Maybe I'm squatting. Maybe I have a peanut ball to help that baby descend more. So I think it's finding confidence instead of fear, because who wants to be told, oh my gosh, I don't know if that baby's going to come out of your pelvis. That's not going to help somebody relax into birth.
Exactly. But you know what as well? I think a lot of the fear comes from some, not all, but some healthcare providers as well, because when you think about, you know, like a lot of the doctors that I've worked with in high risk units, they've only ever seen and been involved with high risk births, because over here in the UK anyway, obstetric doctors are only called when there's a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, most babies that are born straightforward, no complications, are delivered by midwives. I say delivered. I don't like that word really, but I'm going to say it for the purpose of this podcast. But by midwives. So when you've got a doctor who only ever really attends births if they're doing an assisted birth, so forceps or suction or cesareans, or coming in to help free a shoulder that's been stuck, of course they're going to be on high alert and high guard all the time, because that's all they're used to. They're not used to going to a home birth and spending 12 hours with somebody in labor. They're not used to that because they don't participate in that area of it. They just come in at the last minute when help is needed.
Right.
So it's considering that as well, you know, having somebody on your team that is confident, because if they're not confident themselves or if they're fearful, then that is going to kind of project in what's being offered to you.
Yeah. I actually worked with a care provider, several times when I was a doula, and I saw a big change in attitude. And what one of the nurses told me was that doctor had dealt with a really complicated shoulder dystocia between the times I'd worked with them. So the first several times, everything seemed confident and smooth. And then a couple months later, when I worked with that care provider again, there was definitely a different energy and attitude, and then kind of getting the curtain drawn back, like, oh, because they had a fear, they had a trauma,
yes,
of dealing with shoulder dystocia, and that then colored how they approached the people after them.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think that's why, like, as midwives over here, that's why I think it's been so useful to for me anyway, to work in lots of different settings and to see lots of different types of birth. Mm-hmm. Because it kind of opened my eyes up a bit more. And over the years, I've become more and more experienced. I've kind of, you know, I've gone from being this high-risk labor ward midwife, you know, who is dealing with inductions and assisted births and cesareans and drips, you know, IVs and women being strapped to the bed on monitors, to moving out and seeing, working in birth centers and understanding physiological birth and actually how that works and how we can often cause a cascade of intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we really do sometimes. And sometimes, like I said before at the start of the podcast, sometimes intervention is needed. It really is. But, you know, a lot of the time it's not. And it's just confidence from both the person who's giving birth and the person who's facilitating that birth.
Yeah, I agree.
Person.
So we covered some very definitive, yes, this is medically indicated. We covered a couple that not necessarily medically indicated. What might be some gray areas that someone may be considering induction and they don't fall really in either camp?
You come across some people who request an induction for social reasons. So perhaps they, I don't know, they might have a close relative who sadly has got terminal illness or something like that.
Mm. And it's like scheduling.
Yeah, so they want that baby to be born so that they can, you know, understandably, take the baby to visit that close person to them. So things like that. So induction for social reasons. Other times people have experienced a loss themselves, for an unknown reason. Perhaps they've experienced a stillbirth or even a neonatal death. And this time round, they don't want to wait. They want to, you know, they want to meet their baby. Mm-hmm. So again, they may well, request that. I mean, over here, we don't tend to have physicians that, you know, want to schedule in an induction because it suits them, because of the healthcare system works differently over here. It's not privatized. And unfortunately, when you give birth over here, you often don't know who is going to be there to kind of catch your baby. It could be whoever's working on shift at the time, rather than your designated OBGYN or midwife or whatever. Other grey areas, I guess, again, we already spoke about post dates. Perhaps if somebody has previously had a cesarean. So these would be the ones that are hoping for a VBAC. Now, so that's which is a vaginal birth after a cesarean. Policies vary from place to place on induction of labour. Some policies may say that, you know, an induction should be offered at, you know, before the due date. Others will say that, you know, if somebody hasn't given birth by such and such date, then we're not going to induce at all. You know, the person's going to be offered a cesarean section instead. Some will say, well, we will offer an induction, but we're not going to use the prostaglandin gel because that can increase the risk of uterine rupture. So those kind of requests, they're a little bit of a grey area as well. But I think mainly the main kind of grey area for induction are the social
the
reasons.
The request from the parents.
Yeah. From either side, yeah.
That is really, really helpful. So we've talked about, again, the yes, the no, the maybe. So now some people might be thinking, all right, so if I fall into the yes or even the maybe, what is the process? Do you mind just sharing? We talked a little bit about like the prostaglandins and the pit and the amniotomy, but would you mind just painting a picture of a typical process of induction and then how to make it smooth and hopefully a successful induction?
Yeah. So do you know what the process of induction, it varies depending on the person, mm-hmm. and how favorable.
Yeah. And where their cervix is.
Their cervix is. Yeah, absolutely. And how many babies they've had before. So, what would usually happen is you would go into hospital, because inductions cannot occur in a birth center and they cannot occur at home. So it would have to be a hospital birth. So you would go in, and the first thing that's usually done is the baby's monitored. So you've been strapped on the monitor for about half an hour or so, maybe a little bit more. And just to make sure baby's okay, because the last thing that we want to do is to start the induction process, to start giving you drugs if your baby's heart rate is not, if your baby's not happy. Because that can make things worse. So once we've got a nice trace and the baby's heart rate's okay and we know there's plenty of movement and all is okay, then the next thing would be to do a vaginal examination to examine the cervix. If the cervix is completely closed and it's long and it still feels hard, there's been no changes at all, which is what you would expect if somebody's a full term. I know there's this big obsession about checking cervixes and, you know, my cervix hasn't dilated and I'm 38 weeks pregnant, but I wouldn't expect it to at that stage. If the cervix is completely closed, then you would be given either a pessary, so which is like a little tablet put behind the back of the cervix, or a gel, which contains a prostaglandin hormone. And that hormone is usually secreted by the cervix when you go into labour naturally to help soften the cervix, and it helps it start to kind of thin out, you know, a face. So sometimes that is enough to actually kickstart labour, you know, and lots of people, the labour starts just by giving the prostaglandin gel or tablet. If you're given that and nothing happens, then you'll be offered another dose at a later stage. So it could be, depending on the hospital's policy, it could be 6 hours later, it could be the next day, it just depends. And then most people will respond to the prostaglandin and the cervix starts to dilate a little bit. But if it's still not enough to kickstart labour and they can get a finger inside the cervix, they may try to break the waters next. So that's just the membrane sac around the baby. And they do that using an amni hook, which is like a plastic stick with a hook on the end, which is passed through the vagina into the cervix. And it just literally just kind of cuts open the membrane sac. It doesn't hurt. It can feel a bit uncomfortable, but it shouldn't actually hurt. And again, sometimes that is enough just to get labour going. So you've had the prostaglandin gel, you've had your waters broken, sometimes that can be enough just to kickstart the whole process. If a couple of hours have passed by and still no contractions, nothing, then the third stage would be to put the synthetic oxytocin drip. And this drip starts the contractions. So those are the three main steps, but it all depends on the person. So say you go in and your cervix isn't closed, say it's already open, then you don't need the prostaglandin. All you'd need is for them to break your waters and then potentially start the oxytocin drip if you don't start having contractions.
Do you guys use a Foley bulb there?
Sometimes, but in some situations. So say for example, somebody's had a wants to have a VBAC, but they are having an induction and we can't use a prostaglandin, mm-hmm. then a Foley bulb might be used, but they're pretty uncomfortable. So we try not to use them where possible. Mm-hmm. So it's usually just the gel and the breaking the waters and then the drip. But the Foley bulbs are used, yeah, in some circumstances.
Yeah, this is why I always love when I speak with people from different places, because even in the U.S., different cultures of, like, what we do in New York might be different what someone does, you know, in California. So it's mm-hmm. different cultures. So I find it really interesting. This has been so helpful. I think that those listeners that are hearing this will get a better idea of when something is medically indicated, when it's gray, when it's not. So I want to switch, unless there's anything else about induction that I didn't ask that you're dying to share.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to bear
sure,
in
sure,
mind.
Sure.
Yeah. So when you have an induction, it's highly likely that you'll need to have continuous monitoring. Mm-hmm. So you will more than likely be strapped to the bed, and you'll obviously have cannulas, you'll have IVs in your hand or your arm for the fluids to go in. And it's important to understand that if you have the oxytocin, the synthetic oxytocin drip, that they do produce stronger contractions. Mm-hmm. It's not like having a normal, it's not like going into labor normally. So because of that, majority of people who are induced will opt to have an epidural to cope with those contractions, because they're very, very different to normal labor contractions. So it's worthwhile bearing that in mind.
Yeah, the whole hormonal blueprint is different.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, I have a wonderful podcast. So listeners, take a look at the show notes, because I have a wonderful podcast with Dr. Sarah Buckley about this. So those that are listening, head to the show notes. You can hear that's another whole conversation.
Amazing.
But one thing I'd love to also add, and I suspect Marley would agree with this, is if you're having an epidural, use a peanut ball and recognize that type of movement can help baby facilitate down and out, because we don't want, I believe, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, that we don't want somebody to get quote unquote fail to progress, because the induction, I hate the word failed. So learning how, if you're having an induction, if you know that's going to happen, making sure, listeners, that you examine ways that you can still be proactive and making space for baby to descend and rotate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Movement is so important, but it's obviously more difficult when you've got an epidural.
Yeah, it is.
And it depends on the anaesthetist that's actually placing the epidural, because they, you know, sometimes they do like a real hard block, and so you can't even lift your legs up. And sometimes you can have something which we call over here a mobile epidural. I don't know if you call it the same thing over there, or low dose epidural.
It's called a walking epidural, but no one's really walking.
No, what it allows you to do, it allows you to kind of shuffle around on the bed and perhaps go on your hands and knees if you want to, or maybe you sit up and swing your legs over the edge of the bed. But it's unlikely that you're going to be walking up and down the corridor, of course. But it's worthwhile having that discussion, because it means that you can move. Even if you have a heavy epidural, you can still move with a bit of help. And using a peanut ball, like you said, can really help to increase that space in the pelvic outlet, you know, to help baby descend down. And sometimes, you know, when somebody's had a slow labor, rather than saying, oh, you know, failed to progress, let's just whiz her down for a cesarean, actually, how about as long as mum's okay, and as long as baby's okay and there's no problems, let's change the position. Mm-hmm. Let's turn her on her side. Let's change the position. Allow baby's head a chance to rotate and come down further into that pelvis.
Yes.
Let's wait and watch and see what happens. Let's give them a bit more time.
Yeah.
Because often there's too much rushing, you know. But yeah, peanut balls, I'm definitely a fan of them.
And doulas, but that's... I know I'm a little biased. Yeah. I'm not. All right. So I want to talk about your book. It's fantastic. I looked through it. It took me a little bit. I couldn't get it on Amazon. So I had to get it through, there's something else. I got it electronically. And it was such a joy to look through. You did those drawings, right? Are those yours?
Yeah. So they're all over my Instagram. So I started doing those drawings like 3 years ago. And it was silly, really, because when I put the first one up, I thought, oh my gosh, people are going to think this is ridiculous. It's like a 5-year-old has drawn them. But everyone loved it. And
great.
And now I just use them to explain different aspects of pregnancy and birth. So yeah, I've illustrated it throughout.
But what I appreciate about your book, and I would love for you to share a little bit, is it was just easy to read. I have read many pregnancy, birth, childbirth education books. This, and some of them are a little hard to digest and get through. And some are too simplified. I'm like, who are you trying to talk to? This was an easy read, digestible. You weren't talking down to anyone. It just kind of laid everything out there. Do you want to talk a little bit about your book?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the idea, really, because I remember being an 18-year-old first-time mom, and there wasn't really much back then anyway. We didn't have the internet. You know, there was a couple of like textbook type pregnancy books on the shelf that were so big and it would take you hours and hours to read and hard to digest. So I wanted to create something that, like you said, wasn't oversimplified. And I know a lot of the chapters in my book are quite short, but I try to get to the point as quickly as I can and as succinct as I can, taking into consideration everybody's kind of reading ability and learning ability and concentration as well, because I know that there's a whole section on the fourth trimester, which is, you know, after you've had the baby. And if somebody's reading that, they've just had a newborn, they don't want to be reading, you know, pages and pages and pages and pages of complex text.
Yeah.
If they want to find out why their baby's crying, they want to have a book where they can just flip open the chapter, have a quick read and go, ah, great, I'm going to try that, you know? So I just wanted to write a book that I thought would appeal to everybody, which is why it's called, obviously, Midwife Marley's Guide for Everyone. You know, whether they're a first time mum, second time mum, regardless of what, you know, their family situation is, whether they're a single parent, whether they're in a same sex couple, you know, whether they're a surrogate, whatever your situation is, I wanted this book to be for you. So that's where the concept came from. And obviously making it a little bit fun as well, which is why I've kind of added those doodles in, because being a mum myself, you know, a lot of the images that I drew, came from, you know, experiences that myself and I know other people have had. So I hope that people can resonate with them, you know.
They just also make me smile. I don't know, something about them just makes me smile.
I'm glad.
Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back, do you have one final tip or piece of advice you'd like to offer new or expecting parents? We'll be right back. So you have already offered us so much to think about, but from your many years as a midwife, as well as being a mother to 5 children, what is one final tip you want to leave people with?
My final tip would be to educate yourself. Learn as much as possible. And remember that your birth support, the people you have around you when you're having a baby, are going to have a big impact on how your birth pans out. You know, so that's your birth partner, your doula if you have one, and you know, the health professionals facilitating your birth. So it's so important that you've got people around you that are in your corner, that are supporting you to have the birth that you want. And something else, actually, don't be afraid to ask questions, and remember that this is your body, your baby, and your birth.
Yeah, I mean, that is educating yourself, asking the questions. Because as we talked about in the beginning of our conversation, making informed decisions, it's so very important.
Absolutely. It really, really, really is.
Where can people find all the work you do, including your book?
So I have a website, which is midwifemarley.com. People can get in touch with me there or on socials. I'm at Midwife Marley everywhere. So Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok.
All places.
Yeah, Midwife Marley. I'm easy to find.
And then where can they get your book?
So my book is available on Amazon. It does vary by country, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was taking me like 2 weeks to get it. I was a little bit surprised.
Oh, I know, it's a bit of a pain, but obviously the ebook is downloadable straight away.
Yeah, that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah, but depending on what country you're from, maybe a bit more difficult. I know there are some smaller bookshops that are selling it. So what I would do is I would just put Midwife Marley book into Google, and it should take you to one of the bookshops that you should be able to order it from, depending on which country's Google you're using.
So I don't think this will come out in time for Mother's Day, but those, maybe you can think of it for next year for people, but those that they know friends that are going to be pregnant, this is a great Mother's Day gift. It really is. It's such a nice, again, I read a ton of these books and I just enjoyed the easiness of it. It didn't make me stressed out. I think new parents, there's so much information being thrown at them
and it's overlapped, isn't it?
It is. And it's stressful. So that is why I was excited to chat with you because, I mean, many reasons, but that especially is like, I want to support this because I want people to feel confident and not overwhelmed. And I think you achieved that very well.
Oh, thank you so much. You know what? It's interesting. You reminded me about Mother's Day because it was Mother's Day here, literally 4 days before my book was released. So like the end of March, I was like, oh my gosh, I could have had it out in time for Mother's Day, but
next year.
Yeah, next time.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.